I'm Isaac Dover. Welcome to Off Message. Today's guest, the co-chairs of the House's Problem Solvers Caucus, Tom Reed, a Republican from New York, and Josh Gottheimer, a freshman Democrat from New Jersey. The biggest tax reform package in history will pass with bipartisan support in conjunction with the largest infrastructure package in history. It sounds crazy to a lot of people, but they predict it'll all be done by early 2018. The caucus is a reincarnation of an old no-labels idea, but now it's been given new structure and substance, and 36 members equally divided between Republicans and Democrats who pledge to follow set bylaws and actually work toward solutions. The swirl around Russia has slowed everything down, but they have met with both House Speaker and Paul Ryan and House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi this week, and that's given them a lot of hope. I talked to them in Reed's office in the Rayburn Building on the Hill one evening earlier this week, and they were sitting side by side, joking around with each other, having a good time. They are clearly, truly friends at this point. Question is whether they can get anything done. Reed said, and we should note, Reed was one of the first members of Congress to endorse Donald Trump for president and is pretty close to him. He said the president has learned from the Obamacare repeal fight, and he predicts a more inclusive approach from a president he calls cerebral, which is not a word you often hear people describe Donald Trump with. He said the more people that can see that side of the president, I think they'd be more comfortable with him. But then I asked Gottheimer if that portrait made any sense to him, and he said he didn't even know the president. He'd never been in a room with him other than one conversation at the State of the Union. So it's a lot of cheery bipartisan talk. The question is, can it get to anything? Reed's response when I asked him if Paul Ryan had the sway to get anything done or shift Trump, he said he didn't know. His response when I asked him if John Boehner would be more effective if he were still Speaker, he talked about how Boehner had a lot of relationships that Ryan just doesn't have, but he said he's developing them. When I asked Gottheimer if Democrats would have started impeachment proceedings against Trump if Pelosi were Speaker instead, he just said, oh man. Reminder to subscribe and rate us. We have great guests coming up that run the range of Wyclef Jean to Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse. Follow me on Twitter and Facebook at Isaac Dover. Email me at isaac@politico.com. Let me know your thoughts. And of course, go on to politico.com/podcast survey and fill out our survey there. Let us know what we should be doing better. And now, Tom Reed and Josh Gottheimer. So I was talking to one of your colleagues a few weeks ago, and I said, do you enjoy your job? And said, member of Congress said to me, it's like going to the gym. You wake up in the morning, you don't really want to do it. You go and you go through it and you don't like it while you're doing it. But then at the end of the day, you feel better for having done it. and then you wake up the next morning and do it again. Is that fair? What do you make of that?
Well, I guess I'll go first here, being here since 2010. I can understand.
Pulling seniority on you.
I'm pulling the seniority on you, okay. Josh.
And I guess just for listening purposes, Tom Reed is going first, seniority.
And then we'll have the younger member go second. But being a member is sometimes the most rewarding job I've ever had. And it's at times also the most frustrating. And so I guess I can relate to the gym analogy. But overall, I mean, there's a lot of good men and women here that we've gotten to know. And they're just solid people. And it gives us an opportunity to be part of the national conversation. I don't know what Josh, being a relatively newbie.
Well, I'm brand new. Right. I've been here since January. I'll tell you, I'm still in the part of the workout where the adrenaline's pumping. So, which is, by the way, why I go to the gym in the morning to, wake up and get rolling. I still believe there's plenty of places where we can get things done. So that keeps me, even with all that's going on, optimistic. And, not every day is a picnic. I think that's fair to say, but there's still places where I'm still hopeful. And, and truthfully, there's been people ask me all the time now because I'm brand new, what's most surprising. And most surprising to me is actually the people. If you make an effort, people get on really well and people are good to each other. And there's plenty of good people here. But it's a matter of effort. And then the question, what can you do with it?
What percentage of your colleagues do you think make that effort at this point?
It's hard to put a number on that, but I mean,
but do a lot of people make that effort?
Yeah, I feel that people,
because way, right, that people see from a distance what happens in Congress,
right,
is that you guys are just either raising money all the time or not talking to each other and at war with each other constantly.
Well,
is that impression?
Well, I think the institution is structured not to reward cooperation and people coming together, right? You go to your own caucuses, you sit on separate sides. It takes effort. Right. I mean, I think that's fair. Do you
have to it's fair, but I will tell you that the general public perception, and I've shared this quite often back home, is much different than the day to day. Most of the members to a T, you know, they want to get things done and they're human beings. And if you make that effort and let's be honest, I mean, we're in a public position. Most of us are comfortable talking to people we don't know. So getting to know people is a natural skill that I see most members having, just the nature of the business. And so most want to develop friendships, most want to develop the relationship. But to Josh's point, the structure of the organization is such that, you know, when you got your time commitments on the Hill, off the Hill, it's tough to develop those relationships.
You're the Problem Solvers Caucus. It's the problem that people aren't trying, right? Because you say that the House is full of people who want to get things done. And yet you look at the last 4 months and the years before that, and things, not a lot of things are getting done.
Well, but I would also disagree with that, though. Because, I mean, I've been here with the highway bill, for example, got done, the dock fix made permanent. You know, end of the year, we got the tax extenders done, the PATH Act in 15. Those are major policy initiatives that they told us when we got here, you would never get it done, you'd never succeed. Those were bipartisan bills. And I think a lot of it had to do with John Boehner's leadership and the leadership always wanting to try to find a path to a deal. And at the end of the day, you know, I think there's more that gets done than people give credit to the organization and the institution for. But to Josh's point, it does take effort. And, you know, some of the most enjoyable time I've had here is when I've traveled with members, when I've traveled with members on the other side. I can remember going to South Korea with Karen Bass, a California member, a solid Democratic, very liberal in her makeup. And I'm a fiscally conservative Republican. And we got along great because we spent that amount of time together, got to know each other personally. And that has developed into a relationship, a friendship that we carry to this day. And so I think the more members have an opportunity to do that, and that's why I think our Problem Solvers Caucus provides some of that opportunity. And, you know, that's what I'm interested in, is really developing those relationships and those friendships. And maybe that just comes from being the youngest of 12 and being taught, you know, in order to survive in life, you gotta talk and live.
So it's eight sisters.
Yeah, when eight sisters and four boys, and I'm the youngest of them. So, you know, that's what Mom taught me early on. You know,
you're one of how many?
One of two. I'm the older. Yes, I've got a younger sister who's expecting a baby any minute now. So I'm very excited.
You are. So it's not the same lesson that you learned from Tom, right? And
I didn't have as big of a family, but you know, my dad owned a small business. And I used to work in the store and the warehouse.
What kind of store?
And he sold like toothpaste and mouthwash and Russell Stover candy, that kind of stuff. And so we learned from a really early age, you got to work and you got to also be good to people and treat people well if you want them to come back. And so I think I learned a lot from that too. And education, you know, it was very important at home. You know, you work hard and you study hard. And so, you know, those are all things that I think helped me. And now you just want other people to have that shot.
You mentioned Speaker Boehner's leadership. He has not been the speaker for a little while now. How does what you're seeing out of Speaker Ryan compare?
Well, you know, obviously, getting to know the speaker, presently serving with him on the committee for 7 years, highest regard for Paul Ryan. Knows his policy inside and out. You can't go and say that he doesn't know the issues.
But how would it be different if John Boehner was still the speaker over the in the time since the fall of 2015,
you know,
when he quit?
I think Speaker Boehner had a unique quality of really people getting to know him, respect him, knew him personally. Paul maybe doesn't have as deep of those relationships that maybe Speaker Boehner had, but he's developing them. He's a very likable guy. He's a Midwesterner, hunter, fisherman. He can relate with people just like anyone else. But, you know, as I see the environment today versus before, a lot of similarities, and it just takes leadership. And we'll hopefully be part of that effort here with the leadership we're providing in the Problem Solvers Caucus.
Do you think things would have been different if over the last year and change, John Boehner had been speaker rather than Paul Ryan?
No, because, you know, obviously the speaker, Speaker Boehner, at the time when he left, I think he realized that there's a limited amount of political capital that you have in the speaker's office, any speaker. And each one of them burns that capital at different rates, but eventually burns it. And so to say that if it would have been different if he was here or not, that's
wouldn't have been different at all.
Well, of course you'd have different leadership style, right, and you'd have different outcome.
You met with him, talked about the Problem Solvers Caucus. What was your impression of that conversation? You're a Democrat meeting with the Republican Speaker of the House. Did you get the sense that this is the beginning of something actually happening?
I think if we want to get anything done, it's going to take as a body, right? And really where we can come together and not just allow partisanship to rule the day. You know, it's going to take meetings like we had today with Democrats and Republicans sitting at the table and saying, okay, on issues like tax reform, right, infrastructure, how do we get into this conversation together and figure out what it's going to take to move the ball down the road together? And I thought it was a great meeting because it was a first step in that process.
Had you had a conversation with him before? Or is this like the first time you really talked
to him? I see him in the gym most mornings. and, you know, we talk about Springsteen and John Bon Jovi. We're playing them. You know, we all work out very near each other. He does P90X.
I've heard about that.
And I do this cross training with a group of a good bipartisan group. And so we're all basically right on the same
bipartisan cross training. That's
it's well, you know, Mark Wayne Mullen from Oklahoma, he runs it up, and you know, Mark Wayne,
and
he was an MMA fighter, which means it's an incredibly tough workout, and it starts 6:30 every morning, and by 7:30, like I'm done, but of course I see the speaker most mornings.
But this is the first time you really talked with him about. I mean, you've only been here for 4 months.
Yeah, this is the first time we've really dug into policy together.
Was it really digging into policy, or was it more?
We got a little wonkish at times. I mean, just because of the nature of how the
speaker
is.
Talking tax reform and talking about it with Paul Ryan, right?
And to me, I took that as a positive sign when he engaged in a policy substantive manner. To him, when I've seen that before, that means he's taking the conversation seriously and he's appreciating the conversation.
Do you think he can make that case to the president, to the people in the White House who you've been critical of not doing that when it came to the healthcare bill?
Well, you know, I'm hopeful, and that's really a question for him, not for me. But I think I heard today that he was willing to engage, and I think that's a great first step. And tomorrow we're meeting with Leader Pelosi and hopefully continue that conversation. But the idea here is, you know, you won't get anything done together unless you engage together, and you have to take the first step and start. And I thought today was a really important step in that process.
You know Speaker Ryan, you know President Trump, you worked with them. How do you see that developing? Is it really good? Do you think that the president learned lessons, that the speaker learned lessons from what happened on healthcare, that they might do things differently, that this is a conversation that you guys had with the speaker that might lead to or might be part of a process of things going a little differently?
Oh, absolutely. And working with the administration, being one of the first eight Republicans to endorse him, being on the transition team, being over to the White House on a regular basis, I can tell you this caucus, I think, is something that they're eager to engage with. They see the potential that this offers. And, you know, as they went through the healthcare debate, you know, that was difficult. It was difficult to get 218.
And you're in this weird position because you were so early with President Trump. You end up being like the translator for him sometimes to your colleagues, right?
On occasion. We've delivered the message and
you speak Trump.
Communicate with them. But being a New Yorker, I can relate to that too. And being a New Jersey guy, I think Josh can maybe sense a little bit.
I think Josh actually is from closer to the president's backyard.
That's true, than my backyard. But being a New Yorker, I can relate to a lot of what the president comes at issues with.
When your colleagues are talking to you about the president now, what are you saying to them when you're doing your role as Trump translator?
Yeah, I will tell you, the more time I spend with the president one-on-one, the more I'm comfortable with him. I also have seen both the PR side and the public persona versus the individual in a small group setting, in a small room, one-on-one conversation. And I will tell you that the more that people can see that side of the president, I think the more and more they'd be comfortable with him and his leadership.
What is that side? That's not a side that obviously is in public.
I would tell you the best way I could describe it is, you know, look at the rhetoric and look at the actions. The actions that the president has displayed to me, and I think when you see the rhetoric, is very measured in relationship to the rhetoric. He's very cerebral. When you actually have
cerebral.
A
cerebral, that's not a word that I often
I hear President Trump, right? Yeah, because the public persona is such. But I will tell you, when he goes out in a room and he's engaging in the debate, when he's engaging with you, he is measuring you up. He is engaging where you're coming from, and from my perspective, people underestimate. That capacity of them. And I see that as a strength. If people underestimate you, that can be a very strong asset as you go through this process.
I'll never underestimate you.
Well, I appreciate that, Josh. I'll overestimate you. No, I'm just
kidding. That sound to you like a realistic portrait of the president?
Well, I don't know him in that way.
That's what I'm saying. From what you see of him, does that make sense as like that you could see Donald Trump being the guy that Congressman Reed just described?
I mean, the truth is I'm focused on what's good for my district, mm-hmm. and what's good for our country, and what we can get done together. And we met with Secretary Mnuchin. I think it was the first meeting on the Hill
he ever had.
Was with our group.
On tax reform.
And we talked about a few issues, tax reform, the debt ceiling. We talked about infrastructure. We covered a bunch of issues. But I believe we need to sit with anybody, whether it's the Senate or people in the House or the administration, to figure out how we get things done for our country that need to get done and move forward. So you have to not go into anything with preset notions. You have to say, okay, I'm going to be open-minded because if we can move the ball forward here and I want to win for my district and for New Jersey, that's great. And that's the win and that's what I'm going for. And I know Tom takes the same approach. And frankly, when we talk to each other and we generally talk to each other almost every day, which I feel badly for Tom about, but every day. And, you know, when we talk to each other, it's not, oh, by the way, Josh Democrat, Tom Republican speaking to each other. And that's how I always feel. I feel like Tom's friend now is someone I can trust. And I call him and say, okay, where are we on this? You think we can pull this off? And I think we are getting into the mode where we're figuring out how we get to yes on things. Right. And as Tom always says.
And through that relationship.
What's your interaction with President Trump has not been existing.
I met him after the State of the Union.
Right. And that's it.
The joint session.
But that's my question, right? Problem solving would require the speaker being in a different place than things have been so far. You had a good meeting with him. Isn't it an issue that you haven't, you're the co-chair of this caucus, but you are a Democrat, right? And you haven't ever had
I've talked to the administration. I might not have talked to the president yet, but I mean, there's plenty of people who work in the administration. And we've had conversations with other people in the administration about where we're finding opportunity and so I don't need to talk to the president yet.
But I would say that I think this is a natural evolution of this process. As we gain more and more credibility, we took the public position in the funding bill. Members of the Democratic portion of the Problem Solvers Caucus voted for the rule, a Republican rule. Those are huge leadership roles that these guys have done that I think gets respected and is giving us credibility. Then I think there's just a natural progression where, as was stated today, they need to be there at the beginning. If you're going to be part of solving these problems, I think the White House will be open to that. I think the speaker demonstrated today an openness to that conversation. But I won't speak for the speaker and I won't speak for the White House. But I do believe in my heart of hearts that role can develop and easily develop because both the speaker and the president want to get things done.
Do you tell the president to meet with Democrats more?
I have encouraged. And I will tell you, talking to Democratic members who have been to the White House, there are Democratic members who have been to the White House more now in this administration, is my understanding, than they ever were with the Obama administration.
Well, Barack Obama did not like to have any members of Congress over to the White House.
Yeah, absolutely correct on that. And so that's why I encourage
or anybody else who was in politics, basically.
Any politician was persona non grata down at the White House in the prior administration. Totally. And I felt that myself, writing personal handwritten notes to the president and not even getting a courtesy response from a staffer.
Were you ever at the Obama White House other than like Christmas parties?
Other than those type of events? One time. One time I was invited down to talk about policy.
With him?
With him and a small group of members. And I'll never forget it because I was the least senior member there. So I was the last one in the queue to ask questions. And after the third member went, he essentially pushed himself away from the desk and said, "This isn't my problem. This is your problem."
What was that a conversation?
It was about the fiscal cliff, one of the fiscal cliffs that we were looking at. And I stayed up all night before to sharpen my pencil and I'm going to be talking to the president about policy. That's what I came here for. Da 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 da. And it was clear that he did not want to engage with members. It was some personal disregard for us up here. And I heard that from Democratic colleagues too. So, you know, I think it was just a different style. This administration, this president, I know he's about developing relationships. And I think by inviting members down there, and I think that's going to be a natural evolution for us on the Problem Solvers Caucus, I think they're eager to do that.
You've 35 members is the current roster?
36. 36. We're at 18 each side.
Do you are more people interested in joining?
Yeah, actually, we're getting more and more.
But it's Noah's Ark rule, 1-on-1.
Yeah, 1-on-1.
Yeah,
1-on-1.
It's also the rule if they want to right give DC a member of Congress that you'd have to find a Republican one somewhere, right?
That, yeah.
So, are there more Democrats or more Republicans interested at the moment?
There's actually we have to count after, but I mean, we have both have lists of people, so now we're just going to match them up and get them there.
Is there like a hazing process?
No, but you have to be serious. No, the only hazing process is you got to be serious about it. And which means you have to be open-minded. And
but
willing.
What does that mean? Do you guys sit with them and say, like, are you serious? What does that entail?
For me, I mean, yeah. We each, you know, handle our own side and then we come together about it and we meet with the caucus. But it's, you know, we are willing to vote as a block on things, which means we have, if you get to 75%, if we take a position on something, we put out a position today, if you get to 75% of the caucus, including 51% of Democrats and 51% of Republicans, we'll take a position and agree to come forward together. And so that means you have to be willing and interested in that, right? And that's not for everybody. And we want people who are serious about being open-minded and getting to yes and figuring out how we're going to, right? And if you go in with the idea we're going to obstruct for the sake of obstructing and we're not going to look for those solutions, then it's probably not the right group for you to join, right? It's not a social club. It's actually a get things done club. And so, right, it's a caucus to get things done. And so that's what we're really, I think when we both talk to people, that's the conversation, you know, that's not for everybody.
And by adopting the official bylaws that we did, it's easy to go over to bylaws with potential members and say, no kidding, because we used to have a Problem Solvers Caucus. Now it's 2.0. The old Problem Solvers Caucus came out of the No Labels organization. And it was a good informal place for us to get together, have a cup of coffee and get to know members. But there were a lot of members. I think we had 70 some members at our highest level during that period of time. It was clear these members wanted to have the bipartisan seal of approval, right. The no labels problem solver seal. So they would go back to their districts and they would campaign on how they're part of the problem solvers group and then come back here. And I can tell you, they were throwing off bombs left and right. They weren't sincere about it. So I've had some
everybody wants to be called bipartisan. Everybody wants to, right?
Like correct. They want to talk the talk, but they don't want to walk the walk.
What do you say to the Freedom Caucus people, the Tea Party members who I think it's fair to say are probably in a different place on the idea of compromise than you are?
Yeah, I mean, some I respect because they're representing their district and they have a philosophy that they're pure and they want to adhere to that philosophy without any deviation. To me, again, being raised as a practical individual, I mean, my mom was a single mom. My father passed when I was 2. And, you know, in 12 kids, we were learned. If you can get 70-80% of the loaf, that's a success. And you should celebrate that. And then continue the dialogue to see where you can continue to move forward.
Are they hurting the process, some of them?
Some of them, in my opinion, are more about it's easier to vote no, to be perfectly honest with you, than it is to govern and vote yes. I can take a no vote any single day, and I can explain that no vote and why I took that no position. But to actually be held accountable to a yes vote is completely different.
You think there are Freedom Caucus members who are not sincere about getting to yes?
I think there's some members who philosophically and based on the ideology and also the districts they represent, they're adhering to their principal position because that's what they believe and that's what their district sent here to stand with. Other members of the Freedom Caucus who are maybe more, it's easier to take a no vote than a yes vote.
So they're just voting no matter what.
Right? I think they're just at times just voting no because it's the easier path because you know, if they take a yes vote, they're going to alienate some purist on their side. From my perspective, every vote I take, I can explain in good faith. That's why we do the town halls back at home. You know, people are yelling and screaming at us, but I have always told them, I'll tell you where I stand and why I stand where we are.
You've got some people on the left among Democrats and members of the House, your colleagues, who want to emulate the Freedom Caucus, essentially, and just resisting every possible vote, everything that comes out of the White House. What do you say to them?
Well, I think there's a big debate in the party about that right now, right? I mean, some people say, well, the best thing to do is follow what they did And, you know, this was their roadmap.
Right, so they say, well, it worked politically.
Ryan, right? Why not follow their roadmap? You know, I say that's not exactly why. I don't think people hire you for that. You know, people and where I'm from, I think they sent me here to do a job, and our roads are crumbling. Our taxes are too high. You know, we've got other issues. My job is to help address them. And I think if I just walk away from the table and refuse to engage, that's not doing my job. It's not why people hire me. I also don't think it's what the American public wants. I think they want us. They might, listen, I don't agree with what your side did on a bunch of stuff, like that, you know, wouldn't give the other side a win. I think that was the wrong approach. Doesn't mean that I should just copy it. And I don't think that was what's best for America, and certainly not for my district.
Do you think it'll be what's best for the Democratic Party, or?
I don't know. It's too... That's a great big TBD. Yeah. I think if we get
but
things,
that side is winning at the moment.
I think
right?
if we get things
in the spirit of things,
there's certainly
it's obviously not what you guys
that's
agree.
Certainly
with.
Right. That's certainly a loud voice right now, and some people think that's the right tactic. I also think you could argue that there are a bunch of us who think that if you're going to lift all boats and you want to actually have broad based growth, you need to there's things you need to address, and you can't just turn your back. And if you want to win more districts and around the country, you need to be willing to reach out, and you can't just say no. You actually have to come up with ideas and make sure you're out there with ideas, right? And I think that's important too.
You helped the White House come together with its tax reform proposal. How close to what you think could pass the House is what the president put out, what Steve Mnuchin put out?
Well, you know, obviously it was a first step by the White House. And obviously there was a lot of criticism because it was so, you know, one page, very basic. But I will tell you, there was a wealth of information in that one page. There were a lot of us that were concerned that they would maybe just go down corporate only tax reform. It's clear, corporate, business, and individual is what we're committed to and what the White House is committed to. There's a general consensus that we need to lower the rates. And now it's a battle of how low can we go.
So is it a bargaining position or is it an actual proposal?
I think it's a step in the process of creating the final package. Which
like a bargaining position.
Which is not just a bargaining position, but it also it showed how far we are in agreement. Because if that didn't happen, you could have members, you could have senators, you know, going off, well, the White House is only going to do corporate only. And then we waste all that time not realizing that the White House is committed to comprehensive tax reform. That's what I'm getting from that step.
Did it feel like a complete package to you as a proposal?
No, I think I saw it as a first step too, right?
Because one of the criticisms of it was there was not a lot of detail, as you said.
No, it was a leaflet, right? Not a plan. But that's okay. It was, I think, it's a good step in understanding where we're going. And, you know, the details are very important, of course, right? I mean, to me, eliminating state tax deduction is a no-go. Right, because it would be a disaster for states like New Jersey, where we really given what we pay in taxes, which are too high, it's a critical deduction. But that's why you start the process, right? And you sit at the table and you say, I agree that we need to lower rates, right? And I think that we need broad based growth, and I think we really, you know, we're all in agreement on that. And I but now we get into the details. But that's why you need to be at the table.
Is tax reform something that you think could pass in the year 2017?
Yes, or early 18.
I agree with that. I think 2017, given the fact that this is the administration's top priority, given that we on the committee have done such foundational work in regards to this point in time, got great foundational basis and a commitment to get it done. And I think 17 is the realistic timeframe.
How much has the Russia investigation, all these questions about the president, everything that's gone on in Congress slowed down this work?
You know, clearly it's not helpful because the amount of resources that are going to those issues could have been allocated elsewhere. But at the same time, I still do believe guys like Gary Cohn and Steve Mnuchin, who are kind of taking up the lead on tax reform, they are committed in pushing the ball forward in regards to tax reform.
Do you think Democrats would be willing, given what's in the air, given all the political attacks that they are making on the president, given all the questions beyond the political attacks that are being raised here, to give the president any kind of a win on tax reform or anything else?
Well, I think we have to win. It would have to be a win for everyone, right? And I think that's how you have to look at these things. And I think, again, we have to be able to do both things at once. And that doesn't mean you stop accountability. I want to get to the bottom of the Russia issue and understand what kind of meddling there was in our elections. But I also think it's very important to my district to fix our roads and bridges and get our taxes down. And so I think you got to do both.
If you're thinking that tax reform doesn't move until potentially the beginning of 2018, that would seem to suggest that infrastructure, especially the kind of infrastructure package that the president was talking about during the transition, right, of the $1 trillion, that seems unlikely to go at the same time, right? Congress doesn't tend to move giant things simultaneously, right?
Well, I'm personally of the mindset that I see infrastructure and tax reform coming together when we do a deal. It's clear to me, I think there's a lot of appetite
you're
on the other side.
No, I am.
And, yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. You're
nodding, yes.
And yeah. I think that is a natural, because obviously the repatriation of those overseas trapped earnings is a source of revenue that is widely, I think there's broad support to put that into infrastructure spending. So I think that is a natural piece of the puzzle that could help us get tax reform done and also solve our aging infrastructure problem in America. And so putting those two together, I think, is where we end up. Right now, they're running parallel tracks and they're doing their separate processes. But I think at the end of the day,
I'm just going to be skeptical here. You're talking about, given where the politics are, among Republicans, among Democrats, given all the questions that are continuing to be come out because of the revelations around the Russia stuff, given where the president and his aides are, you put all that together, and then every day we get closer to the midterms, there are more Democrats announcing that they're running, even though we're a year and a half out. You think that we're going to get a $1 trillion infrastructure package and the biggest tax cut in history done in the midst of that?
I am very optimistic about that, and I'll tell you why. Because
you
I
agree,
think
it may not be. We don't know the number.
We don't know the number. I mean, obviously, we're shooting towards a trillion, and we're shooting for tax reform.
Sure.
So some infrastructure bill and tax reform done. I really do believe there is a pathway to get to that, and I also believe what's happening. And I think Josh touched on something that I think may have been glossed over a little bit here. If the other side believes that, you know, for obstruction purposes, that the American people want us to play shirts and skins here, they're not getting out across America. And I think they're fundamentally misreading the election of Donald Trump to the presidency. They are looking for disruption in Washington. They are looking for us to change our ways in order to get things done for the American people.
Right.
And so if they're reading it on the other side that, you know what, we need to obstruct for the sake of that's what worked well for the Republicans and, you know, that's what the American people want, I can tell you, yeah, to your extremes and your base, we saw it with our Tea Party movement. Now we're seeing similar situation in the Democratic thing. That may respond well to the base, but I'll tell you, the silent majority of Americans out there, as I travel around the country and back in my district, they want us to govern.
I mean,
they
want us to lead. A reading that's not just your own of Trump's election is that it was people saying, like, enough with the way things are going. Right?
Amen.
It's why, listen, I, you know, beat an incumbent, but I ran for office because I believed also in the silent middle that people, they're sick and tired of this. I ran because I was sick and tired watching it. And said, it's enough. You're going to go there to do something, not just to scream and do nothing. And I really believe that, yes, aside, you're going to have your wings of both parties, but that most Americans want us to do something. And people look at us when we get together, you know, and say, and they're skeptical. And say,
you're chasing windmills.
Right,
you're so naive. I've been told
right,
that.
And I get the same thing from folks on my side. It's about the question of, are you going to show up every day and try to get it done? And that's the job.
I asked him how things might be different if John Boehner were speaker. If Nancy Pelosi were speaker, would we already be doing impeachment hearings?
Oh, man. All I know is that...
given where the Democratic fervor is at the moment.
Well, we'd be in a totally different time if she were the speaker, right? That means we would have had a wave election for Democrats. So who knows what would be going on right now. But I'm hopeful that if she were the speaker, I'd be really hopeful that we'd be reaching across the other side and working together. And that's what I would say.
That's the political answer. But your first response was, oh, man.
I can't even imagine that world right now. Right. I mean, because I'm living in this world. And so you just, threw me one. But
if I could, maybe yeah. I would say I would hope not. And right. And that's where I think the American people are. I
think American, what?
That if she was speaker, that her instinct would be to go to impeachment. That's not good for the American people. That's not good for America. And I will tell you, I would hope she wouldn't do that. But who knows what she would do? And I'll let her speak for that. But I can tell you, knowing Josh and knowing the people in this caucus, I don't think they would do that. They would use the opportunity of leadership to influence the agenda to the best they could. They'd be satisfied with the 80% of the loaf, take the victory for the American people, and then come back at it again for another day.
Let's close with that. You guys are headed back for recess, back to your districts. What do you say to your constituents about why more things haven't happened yet? How do you explain that? You're card-carrying problem solvers. You're talking all the right stuff, right? Bipartisanship, working together.
I point to a victory, to be perfectly honest with you. The funding bill.
The funding bill.
You know, we came together, and I think we were part of that process to provide a mechanism so that we got a bipartisan bill put together. No one written. That didn't make headlines because that's not the... You know, it's not the headline type item. We were governing, and that was a bipartisan bill, high votes on both sides. And that is where I think we could point and say, look, we are getting some things done. We kept the lights on. We moved the ball down the field, and we're setting the stage for bigger victories.
I'm not saying you guys have not gotten anything done at all, but when the constituents are saying, like, well, it seems like Washington's still broken, right? And you point to the funding bill.
I go back to what we did at the end of the tax extender, saying, you know, there's a lot of press out there about the gridlock of Washington, and there's a lot of truth to it. And there's a lot of frustration that American people and as a member, I share with them in regards to hoping we can do more here. But I will tell you that we are having success, and it's small victories lead to bigger victories. And this is what the caucus is doing. This is what the caucus is evolving to. And I'm very confident that this is going to naturally progress. And also, more and more people find out about this. I can tell you, our support is, I travel around the country now, and I get, you know, hey, I know
I love
who you
what
are.
And I love what you're doing. I hear all the time, I love what you're doing with the problem solvers thing. I mean, I hear that all the time. Because people want, I just believe people want you to be doing that. And yes, there's plenty of gridlock. There's plenty of it, right? Plenty of problems and challenges. We all face them, the obstacles that are frustrating and, you know. But these, you have to look at where the hope is and the path to getting things done. And you talk to people about that and say, hey, this is what we're trying to do to actually solve it and to push back on that problem. We got to get back to that time where, you know, Reagan and O'Neill, right? They had a scotch. Now we're drinking Sobe water. And I understand we're not there, but you have
say
to.
We've got to get back to the time. That's what everybody says, but are we ever actually going to get back to that time?
No, but this is, don't you think this is the modern version of that? When we all sit down together and may not be over scotch, but we sit down together and work on things. That is the modern version. I started my career working for President Bill Clinton. He always said to us, and we did it, you know, don't be afraid if there's good ideas out there, grab them. Don't worry if they're Democrat or Republican ideas, just take good ideas. And I think the more people are open-minded to that when they sit down and say, where's a good idea? Let's take it. And we'll all look
but it. I remember when the shutdown happened in 2013, yeah. I did some articles and I talked to people who worked for Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton. They're like legislative directors who, because there was this thing there, oh, wow, remember how good it was in 94, 95 when they got along? They're, are you crazy? It was so awful then, but it's gotten so much worse, or
it's
at least by
worse.
Then, the Gingrich-Clinton shutdown battles were like the halcyon days of bipartisan cooperation. So Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, that's...
No, but you always had... I'm not saying people weren't sitting around saying kumbaya all day.
Right.
But the point is, they were willing to talk to each other and engage. And you had more people who were willing than weren't willing. I think, you know, the problem is we flipped that upside down now, right? So there are more people who aren't willing than willing. And now it's we're building that coalition of people who are eager to sit down. And that's, we've got to find that right group who are willing to do it. And I think that's what we've been focused on.
All right, optimists. Tom Reed and Josh Gottheim.